Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEFCON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEFCON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEFCON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
Well, okay, I know you'll forgive me for standing down here, but it's a lot more convenient to the equipment. Being an engineer, I don't feel comfortable without a lot of wires around that I can trip over. Podiums just aren't that much fun. By the way, have you realized that the effect of encryption and sovereign rights and current laws in various countries now have created a unique opportunity for America? If we were to film a video at MIT on the development of PGP and include detailed techniques about exactly how RSA and PGP work, we could create the first movie made in Boston and banned in France. Anyone old enough to remember that? Now, I've been around in this business for a little while. I am told I was exposed to a Mark II at a very young age. My first memory is playing tic-tac-toe in the UNIVAC in 1957. You're going to have to excuse me, I'm having trouble with my voice. I think it's a dry air here. I'm from Florida, so I'm not used to air. I can't feel going down. It seems like I've spent just about all my career cleaning up other people's messes. This started in the Air Force in 1966 when we were sending email all over the world. It's just you had to know how to use a 66 word per minute teletype to do it. At that point, I was engaged in what was called 306 MOPO in the Air Force. Cryptographic maintenance. The MOP was a skill level because no one without a crypto clearance was allowed in the comm room, so we had to clean it as well. This was also advantageous for poker games because even officers couldn't get in without being admitted and signed in, which always gave us time to clean up the poker table. But even then, we had problems. I used to do a lot of installation, which is really what I'm really good at. And invariably, the engineer's drawings never matched what we were supposed to put in. And somehow, we made it work. Unfortunately, we were very good at making it work, so we kept going into more and more obscure places where they knew less and less about what we were actually doing. To the point that one area we used to go in, let's say there was a team of five of us who would go in and install the equipment, make the comm center work. And there was a squad of rocks from Korea who were supposed to, quote, protect us. Of course, we were never quite sure if we were got overrun exactly who the rocks were supposed to shoot. The other guys or us who knew how the equipment worked. This kept on after I got out of the service. At General Motors, I worked in developing one of the first fiber optic-based infrared systems to control die-casting machines. The interesting thing is this was a 4004-based system in 1974. So this stuff has been around for a long time. The problem I got into there was it worked too well. The union stated we had a speed-up in process because it reduced 30% of the scrap, and it was never adopted. That was one problem I couldn't clean up. However, the 360s were very good for modeling suspensions of Corvettes in high G turns, and I was racing a Corvette at the time, so it was very nice. We go on, let's just skip forward a bit. 88, I was working up in Washington, and they started having this virus problem. Nobody knew what they were, nobody knew what they did, they were just there. So I wrote this little program, because they had a problem with the brain. All it did was look at the top of memory and see how much memory was gone. If you had 640K, everything was fine. Of course, we had machines that had 512K and 256K, so life wasn't quite as easy then as it is now. But The fact of it is, there was only one place for low-level viruses to take memory, and they had to go resident. And they took it at the top of memory, the only place they could. The funny thing about it is that technique of virus detection still works today on every low-level virus known, because there simply is no other place for them to go resident. The thing I consider a real annoyance is that Microsoft came out with Microsoft Antivirus. Do you all know how good that is? It is so good that Microsoft uses FPROC internally. And they only use FPROC because they just switched to that from McAfee's 10. Gives you an idea. Of course, you know, when you see an antivirus that has lines in the code like Eli and Yuval just killed the Lehigh virus, exclamation, 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 you kind of wonder just what the quality of this code is. And you have to understand, because there are a lot of people who trust it. We've got millions of sheep out there that don't know any better. And these are the people who are constantly calling me up for help. If I make a mistake of publishing my phone number. Well, I found that out a long time ago, that if you're going to protect an organization, and really that's what my job is, and I get paid for it, and I get a lot of extras for it that we don't have to talk about. But the main thing is access. And the way I found out that I reduced the load was by telling people how to reach me all the time. Trouble calls went down. Because as soon as people knew they could reach somebody 24 hours a day, they stopped calling. Because they always knew any time they had a problem, they could call. It's like the old secretary syndrome, that if there are no pens in the supply cabinet, the secretary's room will always be full of pens. And I know this is a different kind of concept, but we're talking really about open information to help other people. The thing I've been worrying, I'm going to go real quick over viruses. If anyone has questions about them later, I'd be perfectly glad to talk to them, as long as you don't ask me to write one for you. The one thing I have noticed in the last year, most of the viruses I've received in the mail seem to be from people who couldn't make them work and want to see if I can make them work for them. That's something I just don't do. Now, if somebody comes to me with an intelligent question, I'll answer it. But what I want to talk to you about in this half hour we've got is something that was touched on lightly yesterday, namely internet mail. Now, let's see how long this takes to run. Oh, you can almost see all of that. One of the things besides being a prosthetic monitor was my eyes are the best replacement at work, so sometimes it may look clear to me and it not to you. Can you read that all right? Okay. The first thing very few people understand about the internet is that its real purpose. And they started to talk about this yesterday, but I find it easier if people really understand where things are coming from. There is no security in the internet, period. It's deliberate. The whole purpose of the internet as it was designed as ARPANET, DARPANET, MILNET back in 1967 was to provide communications that would work adaptive, redundant mechanisms in the event of thermonuclear war. Because of that, it is solidly over in the availability. I'm sure you've all seen the CIA triangle before. That in order to have some of one, you have to give up something of another. And the plain and simple fact is the internet is right about here. Clear out on the end past it. It guarantees the mail will go through. That is assuming that there is a host there to receive it. If there isn't a host there, it will tell you eventually. It usually takes 3 or 4 days, but it will try that long. But there is no other function in the internet other than if mail is sent, it will go through. It doesn't care who sent it, doesn't care what's in it. All it cares about is it will go through. And I say mail, and I'm actually talking about a lot of different functions here. Network news, number, telnet, they're all basically the same functionality. Now, all security as a result is up to the user. If you look at the RFC, I believe the 1387, Guidelines of Security of the Internet, Secure Use of the Internet, the last line in that RFC, and RFCs state what the Internet does, is if security were not so widely ignored on the Internet, this memo would not have been possible. You see a lot of that. It is not there unless you put it in. Put it in yourself, put it in the mail, put it in news readers, but there isn't any. We're having a lot of incidents in the last couple of months, couple of years, because people do not recognize that. The TCP is not a matter of just put a stamp on them. And this is another thing people don't realize. They think you can send something out on the internet safely, anonymously. We talked about the anonymous mail servers. That isn't true, because it's a complex handshaking procedure. You don't just send something out. What you have to do is call up the site that you're sending something to. You have to tell it you're going to send. It has to acknowledge the fact. You have to give it a return address. And this is where a lot of people get confused. The fact that the return address can be anything you wanted to tell it is not a bug, it's a feature. I may be a line ahead myself. This is the process internet mail goes through. You first send hello. For some reason, they left the second L out. A lot of people doing this design have a sense of humor. But you say hello. Literally, you send an ASCII string that says hello. And you typically append, you know, the name of the site. Otherwise, it will assume you're calling from wherever you're calling from. But that's not necessarily true, because deliberately placed in the design of the internet mail, internet NMTP, which follows the law, telnet, which is simply terminal emulation, allows you to connect to various sockets. Implicit is the fact that you might not want a reply to come back to wherever you're sending it from. So you're allowed to put anything you want as the reply address. You want to put Sandy Claus at North Pole, that's fine. You want to put Bill Clinton at whitehouse.gov, that's fine. It will accept it because the network doesn't have time to check it. It just assumes whatever you put there is where you want the reply to come to. Okay, you said that's the receipt address. You have to address the letter to tell it where the mail is supposed to go to, just like you address an envelope, except you're doing this in real time in handshaking. Then you tell it, okay, now I'm going to send whatever it is you're going to send. It can be, hello, I love you. It can be, we really don't think you're doing the right thing. You can send anything you want. It doesn't care. You can send encrypted messages. It doesn't care. Now, you know about UUCT, that is not a function of the internet. You can put any binary digits in data you want to, but many mailers strip off control characters. This is the reason you have things like UUN code to send binary data. You don't need FTP to send binary data. You can send it just straight through the email. A lot of people have found out. But mailers strip it. Mailers, like an IBM mainframe, is the worst I can think of. Don't send more than 64K in a message, and don't try to send binary control characters, because it will strip them off. CC mail, if you send it properly, will accept almost anything. But the problem is, you never know what's sitting on the other end of the site. You'd be amazed. Most people think the internet is a Unix environment. It isn't. Unix is one of the environments of the internet, but you would be astounded how many .coms out on the internet are simply PCs, maybe not even a 386 class, sitting on somebody's desk. The one thing about the internet is you can't tell what it is you're connecting to. It doesn't really matter. But each action must be acknowledged by the remote site, and this is the key. In order for the action to be acknowledged, the remote site has to know who you are or where you're sending it from. Like I said, deliberately allows you to specify anything you want, and it is a feature for that reason. So often I send mail, if I send mail from some site out here in Vegas, I may want to receive it back in Orlando, so I'm allowed to. But not well understood is that the header also contains received from lines. How many people ever have seen a received from series of lines? Couple of fans, people are into it deeply, a lot of mailers rip it off. But the fact is, those received from fields specifies where it just received the message from. It specifies when a relay is used, say you go through Cooney in New York, it will give you a second received from line stating where that relay is from. If you send it from a message, it will have a unique identifier tracking it. So if you use a relay site, someone backtracking the message, if it's a commercial site, we'll be able to say, well, where did the original message come from? Even if it was, shall we say, changed in the header. It'll connect the tracing, and this is something that Gail was just a little bit mistaken about yesterday when she was giving the kidnapped child, allowing them to trace calls. Tracing is not covered by the Privacy Act. It's not covered by wiretap regulations. The only thing those cover is what a message contains. Where a message came from is something entirely different and very easy to obtain. I'm not sure why she made that error. It may be deleted by the mailer, but the fact of the matter is it is always there. You hear about Telnet 25, port 25 attacks. All that is a person has replaced the automatic SMTP with automatic return and reply and such generation with a Telnet. And remember earlier I said that the whole mail concept is done through ASCII strings sent and received back, just like you were talking to a computer. A Telnet 25 means that instead of using automatic generation of all these functions, you're entering it manually. Same commands are used, same structures, and if you look at it's as defined in RFC 1340. See, I think a minute ago I put up there where you can find them all in case you're interested. They're all FTPable from ds.internic, I-N-T-E-R-N-I-C, .net. That's run by AT&T. You'll find many more megabytes of data than you really want to read. But it will tell you exactly how all this is done. The receive line will have the indication, even if the telnet is done, you'll see an extra at sign in one of the receive from lines. I got into this a few months ago when a good friend of mine was, let's say, flamed royally by forged email that appeared to come from her account. However, it was very easy to go back to the headers and find out where the actual start was. Now, we dropped it at that point, but the important thing for you to know is tracing not only is possible, it's legal. So if you have thoughts about sending out things, don't assume that just because your mailer doesn't show you that all of your IDs are in there, that the mailer at whitehouse.gov won't know exactly where it came from. It takes them a few days, but they will find out where it came from. I've seen it happen. Same thing is true of network news. The only big difference is the path is the return instead of received from. Anyone here used Tropit and gotten it very confused, so you start getting a stream of error messages on every carriage return, and a couple of those have very involved return addresses in them? What you're seeing are those path statements that Tropit usually conceals. Bottom line, the internet is not like a phone line. It is a packet switch network, and for packet switching to work, the packets have to know not only where they're going, but where they came from. This is in the definition, TCP/IP, I believe it's RFC 791, and 773, is that the other one? One of them's IP and the other one's TCP. And you look at the datagrams, and you will find that all this information must be there for the mail to go through. It won't work. Think of it as a universal caller ID you didn't pay for. You get it free. But there is no star 67 available for it. Anonymous mailer, it was mentioned yesterday, I believe Anon.Pinnit.fi in Finland is the most common. But just how many trunks do you think there are from the United States to Finland? I believe this was glossed over a little bit yesterday, but do you really doubt that packets are not noted as to addresses that are leaving and entering the country? Do you feel safe in thinking that? I wouldn't. Of course, I assume that everything I send on the net is going to be read. So it may help you, but you have to ask about what happens with a sniffer. Now, if you want to get into sniffers, you have to understand, I don't do much in Unix. I've never found anything I really need Unix to do. DOSBox has worked just fine and do everything I need. I've got a couple sitting on my desk, and I've found that three dedicated machines are not only cheaper than a Spark station, but they can do faster work because they're dedicated. Okay. Any network machine can become a sniffer. It's called being put into promiscuous mode, capturing the packets. It's just like if you had a beeper on your belt that captured every phone number that came in, and not just the ones for your beeper. I haven't seen anyone hack them that way yet. Of course, what would you do with all those numbers? Call them. But you can only get the packets that are on your line. You also have to know what you want, because it'll fill up a disk very fast. And one thing that the new active hubs are going to on Twisted Pairwise is they're only sending packets out that are supposed to go to machines on that line. So the sniffer then only gets what was supposed to go to that machine and really becomes useless, unless you have access to interesting places. That's why the panic sniffer was such a problem earlier this year, and why the CERT's been excited about. People have been able to put sniffers in places where there was a high density of, shall we say, interesting packets with things like login and password and username. Because even though they've been around for a number of years, the one-time password token companies are still struggling. People are serious about it, use them, but it seems like very few people do. But there is a problem with the sniffer, and that is, in order to be effective, the sniffer has to be in an interesting location. Interesting locations tend to be monitored and logged quite well. Anyone see about the RifleNet penetration last week? Appeared in Alt Security? A couple of people. You notice that the mechanism was used was quite interesting. They got in, took over root access to the system, created a special daemon operating on socket 3111 that allowed them to retrieve all logins to that system. And the daemon was just recording them as they came in on the normal ports and then saving the information. But those of you who saw the complete report that came out of Rahal said it went in about 6 a.m. one morning. They caught it later that afternoon. They were able to identify from their system logs, and this was the handshaking talking about, the system, I believe it was at University of Pennsylvania, University of Pittsburgh, UPIP. I'm doing this from memory, so no guarantees. But It came from UPIT, let's just assume that, and logged in. They knew what node created the daemon, and after they caught it, they were able to identify that a node also at that same college and a different one, I believe, was at Bennington, tried to access it. Now, how much do they now know about who did it? You know, there is no anonymity, really, in the net, besides they really want to find out who does something, because of the way the structure is set up. Okay, now, if you really want to understand it, the first thing you want to do is get the RFCs. Again, available for direct FTP from ds.internet.net. You have, and I'm talking to your PCs because that's what I use a lot. You'll find the WATCPs from the University of Waterloo in Canada are a very complex and full set of user domains if you're in C. You read the FTP software in Concord, Massachusetts, defines the packet driver specs, how you communicate with the internet. Current version of the spec is version 1.11. And you can roll your own. You can do anything you want with it. FTP software, PC, TCP, and their software development kit is the best stuff I've seen for developing. You can write your own. You can write your security system. You saw in Security Insider Network newsletter from Win Schwartow about AT&T's pingware. This is probably one of the best hacking tools ever put out. They call it a security tool, but they're really isn't any difference between a hacking tool and a security tool, because you're both after the same thing. You want to know where the holes are. Biggest difference is if you have the software development kit and a PC and a NIC for about $300 worth of equipment, you can do anything that the pingware can do on a Spark station, and they charge $6,000 if you need them to help you install it, which apparently everyone does. It's very simple to install. Right. The best device, if you get Bellowen and Cheswick's firewalls and internet security, it will tell you more than you ever wanted to know about which sockets do what. It will tell you which ones should be protected, which ones should be monitored, how to monitor. It is the state of the art in internet management right now. It is as good as Bruce Shearer's Applied Cryptography is to crypto. These are out there. If you must use a Unix box, well, I'm not going to hold it against you. I stopped using Unix probably 10 years ago because I found no need for it, nothing I couldn't do elsewhere. That completes the formal part of my presentation. If we can bring the lights up, if you've got questions on any subjects, I'll try to field them. Anyone? Well, thank you. Oh, Karen.
What do you think you want to say about the virus writing and the virus, the original theme of the topic?
I was asked about updates in virus protection software. I don't update virus protection software. I get all of them simply because it's my hobby. Let me just give you my personal example, and if you're interested, I'll tell you where to get it. I wrote DiskSecure originally in 1990 to complement a different package I was using at the time, NigmaLogix Virus, PC Virus Safe. This was directed at low-level viruses, MBR, DBR viruses, master boot record, DOS boot record viruses, which incidentally today are about 80% of the total viruses known. I found it trivial to catch them. Now the problem I'm running into today, and I can say the same thing about the Satan bug, the junkie is boring once you look at it, but you have to take them apart to find it out. But a real defense just starts out by simply knowing what the PC is supposed to look like in the first place. Integrity management. For instance, The package I'm using, I'm running up against, in the Carroll collection doesn't exist, but if it did, it would have about 634 loop sector infectors in it. And I haven't had any trouble with any of them, because the bottom line to a low-level virus is we have found out, first, it must go resident to be able to infect. Otherwise, it won't do anything, just sit there. Second thing, as I said, it must take up memory to go resident. Third thing, in order to do any action, I'll just talk about it. It must take over an interrupt in order to be executed, otherwise, again, it doesn't have any effect. So you have two functions. The stealth viruses hide themselves by the fact that when you ask for the sector on the disk that they are on, they will return the correct information, the original master boot record. Now, a lot of people thought, this is one called first seen in the brain in 1986. A lot of people thought this was a wonderful idea. In my personal opinion, it is there because the virus wouldn't have worked without it. The machine would have crashed as soon as it infected, so it wouldn't have been a very good virus. The stealth had to be there because during the boot process, the master boot record is actually accessed 8 times to get the disk information. It had to return the correct information to work. So that's where stealth came from. In order to do that, it had to trap interrupt 13, which is, again, the most popular interrupt event to look at. Now, so you have memory residency must trap interrupt 13. At the BIOS time, before DOS loads, all of the BIOS interrupts have to point to the BIOS. If you have a BIOS extension, but the bottom line, because it'll be on a card and slightly different address, but all of the addresses have to be above segment C000. That's the only place hardware exists. The only place RAM exists is below C000. And that is all below 640K, unless you have a VGA adapter and put it in B7FF where the Starship put it. There are only about 3 viruses ever tried to put in the VGA adapter, and it never spread very far. However, it's still under C000. So, every resident virus can be detected with 11 bytes. I don't have enough fingers in the sand. Consider it twice or a couple more. That's all it takes. You just have to step through the interrupt table looking at the high order byte of the interrupt vector. Every virus at the low level. Of course, about 4 years ago, I sent that information to Microsoft and got the reply it was not in their business interest to provide such protection. My opinion, no, sure, I could possibly, I'm not sure if I could write something to get around it. The first to secure I could, because somebody, one of the viruses, the interrupt 10, and this is the length people started going to. One of the problems, they started taking my software apart and seeing what I was doing. So this one put itself in sector 1, where a virus had to go, because that's the first volatile memory read in a PC. When it loaded, it took the real master boot record, put it into memory, stuffed itself into the interrupt table, and captured interrupt 10 instead of interrupt 13, waited for MS-DOS to announce itself, then stuck itself back into the master boot record, and simply so the earliest version of my antivirus wouldn't notice it, because I was only looking at interrupt 13 at that time. Since then, I added the 3 more bytes, so I've looked at all of the interrupts, and that particular attack doesn't work. The second one I saw was when the WXYC came out, and it is appropriate that it was sent to Duke University, which is a quasi-religious school, because it makes a blind leap of faith at the disk and hopes it hits what the thing is aiming for. I mean, I consider this a good thing because the antivirus work has gotten so good lately, and I'm not talking necessarily Microsoft, but just all of them in general, that the virus writers are really straining, trying to find something that will get by, and they're not succeeding really. All the polymorphism, it just makes them hard to remove. It doesn't make them hard to detect. Now, if people were really writing viruses trying to expand knowledge, you would think they try to make them hard to detect, but easy to remove once detected. And instead, I'm seeing exactly the opposite thing. Now, I will touch on the concept of beneficial viruses, because it seems to be very popular. I will entertain the concept, though I find it very difficult to figure out what could be done with a virus that can't be done easier without a virus. And my requirement is that because we just don't know enough about computers. Even people who have studied them for years don't know enough to say on every computer, this is exactly what's going to happen. That's why Windows is such an excellent virus detector. It is better than Microsoft antivirus. It crashes and it gets suspicious. But that's because Windows relies on integrity of the system to operate. All Microsoft antivirus does is scans for known viruses. It won't pick up anything unknown, but Windows will. So it's really a better product from that standpoint. Getting back to beneficial viruses, I'd be willing to entertain it if somebody could show me, first, something that could be done only with a virus. For instance, we've got KOH back there. I took a look at it some time ago. I haven't looked at it in depth. But if somebody can tell me what it does that I don't do with Stacker on my machine, and they have invested a whole lot more effort in making it compatible than I have seen any. I have yet to see a professionally written virus, what I would consider, you know, A-class material. They all have mistakes. Now, the nice thing about the mistakes is take the Michelangelo. That's what made it so easy to detect. It took the same 2K of memory from the top of memory that the stone did, which is a derivative of. He obviously had never seen a 3.5-inch floppy because he assumed anything that wasn't a 360K was 1.2 meg, which is why it gets confused on some 3.5s. But that 2K it took out of the top of memory made it easy to detect. Even when U.S. News and World Report wrote that up. Somebody a while ago said something about, if you get mentioned in Time, that's wonderful. Well, how does U.S. News and World Report count? Or did they come up with the Iraqi printer virus? But the bottom line is, by Occam's razor, the simpler the better. You've heard KISS, keep it simple, stupid. It's a very good way to work, particularly with computers where they're so complex. One of the last changes I had to make to the Disecure, where I went from 2.41 to 2.42, was to accommodate original IBM PCATs with BIOS dated prior to 1 January 1985. There was an obscure bug in there. Zenas are different. I'm sure anyone here use military Zenas, desktop 3, desktop 2? You found they're different? Actually, Zenas is one of the greatest hacking computers known. It has a full debugger built into the BIOS, so you can actually step-by-step through the whole boot sequence, which is one of the exceptions I'm afraid I have to take with a certain book on writing viruses, namely that the boot sector virus only works with DOS 3.x. But that is because a complete description of the register values that must be passed at the termination of a DOS boot record weren't included. And that's something I got very deep into and came to the conclusion there is no universal boot sector that will work with every operating system. You can do it in 5, but you can't do it in 1. So I just have trouble mainly with viruses that people seem to think, who write them, They just haven't looked at all the Compacts and Zenos and Sanyos and Panasonic senior executives that are out there. So there's, the compatibility is a real problem.
Sir? That can be said for any piece of software I've written
out. I'm sorry?
That can be said for any piece of software out there. But
yeah.
There are no exceptions. It's not compatible on our machine.
Yes, exactly. And this is why I really come down on Microsoft and Novell Digital Research, because they can target their operating system. They can guarantee it, but they don't. Actually, I have to say Novell's close. The Search and Destroy actually checks to see if it has a proper amount of memory allocated. It's the only one I know that does that. And now I'm going to, ma'am, you had your hand up first.
Don't you think they don't want to check for viruses because they don't want to claim they checked because of the liability of claiming they
checked? Oh, the false positive problem. Well, I really don't worry about it too much. I think that they can handle it. Particularly if you read the weasel words every lawyer puts on a software package, it says they aren't responsible for anything anyway. I mean, true. Now, there is a problem to that, and you would have to have a switch to turn it off, because it would blow out of the water virtually every low-level security product known, as well as the viruses. All those that say you can't boot from a floppy, because they are effectively doing the same thing viruses do. They go resident, and they prevent certain actions. They lie to you. The problem is, in this case, they aren't going to spread anywhere you don't know about, and they're only doing what they're supposed to do, and in theory, they're removable. Now, my disk here, I put in a password. It's not considered particularly complex. I did, because it only took a few more bytes than I had the room for. The only real answer to security on a PC is full disk encryption. I mean, nothing else will work, and you have to take the chance that maybe you won't be able to get it back. No, it's serious, and this is the reason most corporations won't do that, because too many people forget their passwords. And if you forget that on encryption, you might as well wipe the disk, because you can't get it back, at least. Not trivially, not without the services of people who can pick up trackage, remnants. Very well-funded government organizations can. But it's beyond private applications. Sir?
What do major SCP sites that you know of, what are they doing to scan for viruses and software related?
Okay, what are major FTP sites doing to scan for viruses? Well, first, they bring it in to an incoming traffic area. Then they check it with whatever means they have found appropriate. I always put one into a isolation machine and run. You can't tell, because the Turing rule says you can't always tell the virus. You may only tell it after it's triggered or after it's had an effect. That is, assuming you run outside software at all. So the FTP sites have a real problem, but they use the best available techniques, the best available structures. SimTel 20, it goes into SimTel and is checked out there. You can't even FTP from. You have to go to one of their mirrors after they transmit. Occasionally, it happens, things slip through, but it's getting a lot less than it was a few years ago. I do not consider SimTel, for instance, or reliable FTP site a problem. They have more to lose than you do. Question? Well, if no other questions, I may just be because I can't see a hand. Okay, thank you for your help. Sir? As far as I know, I haven't tried recently. As far as I know, it was taken off of public access and is available only from the MILNET. I'm not going to swear to them, but that's what I believe is true. if you want to try it, it's WSMR-SIMTEL20. Let's see, White Sand Missile Range, SIMTEL 20. Is that? It's been too long, I'd have to look in my notebook.
I arrived a little late, so you may already have covered this, but you said that the only way to stop virus is full disk encryption.
No, I didn't say that. I said the only way to protect a disk from compromise is full disk encryption.
I apologize.
If you use proper encryption, it'll encrypt the virus just as happily as anything else.
What I was going to ask was, back 20 years ago in academia, there was lots of talk of provably secure operating systems, protection models, layers of privilege. 386 and its offshoots all have perfectly adequate hardware protection to allow the operating system to be built. Has anyone done so, and why not? And what's the status of that
Okay, you're talking about the security rings possible in the 386. To the best of my knowledge, no one's ever used it. I think Mach 5 did, but I'm not going to guarantee that. And Mach 5 is usually universally reviled for running too bloody slow. But that's a problem you run into with good security. Basically, a PC, as it comes from the factory, is a single-state machine. And anything that runs has full control over it. And it is true, the hooks are there, but just like the hooks were in an 8088 for a master-slave multiprocessing system, as far as I know, they were never used. And right now, I think I'm getting very close to my plane time, so I've got time for just one more if there's something. If not, you know, if you want to ask me a question, I'm the first Peterson in the White Pages. Thank you very much.